me. Ooh-wee, it's me. Ooh-wee, it's me. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit, so y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along. Ow. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit, so y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the whole way along.
Peace, this is Common, and right now you're checking out Nestorius Public Radio. Y'all stay in tune. Love.
We're here on the set of Hell on Wheels, Season 3, with the Director of Scripted Programming, Mr. Owen Shiflett. What's up?
What's happening?
So we were talking earlier about AMC programming and Breaking Bad and how, like, kind of like an unorthodox show that is, depicting, you know, drug dealing and all this other stuff. And then you have, you know, Mad Men, and obviously Mad Men, both of those shows are coming to an end. But now you have Hell on Wheels. And I say now, but Hell on Wheels, we're on Season 3, right?
That's right, yeah, Season 3.
Okay, so real quick. So you're the Director of Scripted Programming. What does that mean?
You know, I'm essentially manage the creative elements for both current shows and shows in development, scripts in development, for the network. So when a show is going on, like Hell on Wheels has been, you know, we get to have a say in which writers are hired, which directors are hired, you know, which actors are hired, you know, how the story progresses. And in development, we shape scripts so that it kind of fits the mold and the identity of what we think the network is.
Are you involved in the decision making of, for instance, when Hell on Wheels came in as a script and as a concept? Were you involved in the decision making on that level?
Absolutely, yeah. Hell on Wheels first came in as a pitch from Jeremy Gold and Endemol, which wasn't studios at that point, but Jeremy Gold and Endemol, and Donnie and Joe Gayton, and they had this great pitch about life on the Transcontinental Railroad and the various people and personalities that it takes to get it built. And we fell in love with it. And we had, at the time, we were kind of still riding a wave of success from a Robert Duvall miniseries that we had in 2006, I believe, called Broken Trail. Mm. That was basically, you know, about the... it actually filmed here in Calgary too, but it was about a lonesome kind of rancher, Robert Duvall, with Thomas Hayden Church, who kind of escort these women who were these Chinese women who were bound for prostitution, and he kind of like takes them under his wing and kind of saves them. Mm. So a wonderful story. It was a two-night event. It was actually huge for our network. It was the first original programming of the modern age for AMC, and so that created a strong desire to follow it up with another great iconic piece of Western programming.
Mm. And this is 2006. This is before any of these big shows that AMC now has.
That's right. Yeah, it was the very first thing. Mad Men was a pilot, but without a series pickup at that point. Breaking Bad was a script that we were, you know, that we were interested in, but hadn't yet bought. So there's a lot of formulation of the network still to happen. But we knew that we had a large Western audience already at the network, and, you know, when Hell on Wheels the pitch came in, we thought to ourselves, you know, this is going to be our opportunity to capitalize on the Western audience.
So how did the network know that you guys had a big Western, you know, fan base, audience base? How did you guys come to that?
Well, it's like, I don't remember specifically the numbers for Broken Trail, but I think it was like 11 million people watched Broken Trail. So it was a lot. And we hadn't done original programming before that. So it was like, wow, there must be a lot of people. And we also ran a lot of like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood Westerns.
Right.
You know, and so there was like, we were known as kind of a Western theme network at that point.
Got it, because if I remember correctly, AMC was American Movie Classics, yeah?
Yes, but now...
You say, you have like a little smirk on it. Why?
Well, it used to mean that, but now it doesn't mean that.
No, I know now it doesn't mean that, and now it's completely different, and AMC has reinvented itself,
yeah. You
know, to be, you know, one of the ballsiest, on the cutting edge networks on television. I don't even want to say cable TV, but on television. It's pretty, I mean, first of all, Breaking Bad, I mean, that show would never, ever, ever get picked up, let alone be considered,
right?
Just because of the subject matter. I mean, you got a teacher, chemistry teacher, you got crystal meth. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, I know, we were really ballsy, I would say. Like, back in those, I mean, back in 2006, when all of this stuff was kind of coming together, the only mandate we really had was, you know, do something different and make the channel, you know, be whatever we wanted it to be. And that was, so we had like kind of free reign, and it helped that, you know, AMC Networks is run by two guys who have incredible narrative sense. They're like great, have great taste. And, you know, it's one of those things where you're just like, you know, you're blessed to have the opportunity to like kind of make the thing that you want to watch, which is so rare these days, I feel like.
So rare. Those two guys, I don't know them. Great taste and huge balls, I got to tell you. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, I know about network TV. I know about programming. I know about what, you know, gets even considered, let alone, you know, directed and put into a pilot and even picked up. You know what I mean? So, okay. So you had like a little smirk when I said what AMC was before. So how did it come about from that AMC to this AMC?
You know, it just, I think it was a lot of trust and creative, and really like trust that like Mad Men was the first thing that we bought that was more of like a, I mean, it was a spec script that was floating around. We did have some changes made to the script, but for the most part it was Matt Weiner's original vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first thing that we picked up that would have been an ongoing series. And then Breaking Bad was also a spec that we had some changes made to. So both of those were kind of like the things that we knew that were great and that just no one else had the guts to do. So thankfully we had the guts to do it. We picked them up to series, and they've, you know, been iconic pieces of television history, which none of us could have predicted. But, you know, I think going, if you had gone back in time and had 15 scripts that were all in various stages of development, like those two would have been the outliers in any room in the business. So,
right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, so American Movie Classics, the TV for movie people, which was our old tagline.
Right.
You know, it underwent a lot of changes in trying to become, you know, more of the channel it is today, which I think is growing into more of a, you know, full service cable channel, not unlike not unlike a USA or a TNT. I mean, we have that kind of like reach now that we never thought we'd have before.
Right, but you can't even compare what you're doing to either of those two networks. What you're doing just on those two shows alone will blow any of those other networks like to smithereens, just on those two shows alone.
Well, we didn't have the pressure to succeed immediately. So Mad Men, you know, came and went in 2007. It was actually premiered on a Thursday night opposite Burn Notice, of all things. And, you know, Burn Notice right out of the gate was like a very highly rated, piece for its network. But then with us, it was like Mad Men just came and went, and it didn't have great numbers, but, you know, management really believed in it. Thankfully, the fashion industry was actually the first to embrace Mad Men as a, you know, as the iconic piece that we knew it was. And so I think that was like the tastemaker circle that we needed. And so by the time season two came out, you know, there was already a good word of mouth. There was buzz. It mm-hmm. helped that social mm-hmm. media was coming mm-hmm. into its heyday at that point. You know, so, you know, all the Facebook and the Twitter and all of that was actually, you know, all of that was kind of rolling, getting going, and people were sharing what they liked. And Mad Men was a beneficiary. And then subsequently, Breaking Bad also kind of fit right in and was, you know, just quality television that was allowed to breathe, and it was allowed to not, you know, we didn't have to like worry about the show being yanked after three episodes if it didn't make a certain number. We knew that it was going to go on, and then like after it had done airing, it was going to go find an audience, and that audience would want to tell other people about it. We just knew it was good.
Right.
And that was the uniting principle.
Mad Men, very sexy, very classy, very kind of dreamy, like, wow, I wish I lived in that era. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then you got Breaking Bad, which is kind of gritty in a way. Not very sexy, you know what I mean? Not very sexy, but very kind of matter of fact, you know what I mean? Like, I see myself living in that era, you know what I mean, in that time. What is that era? You know what I mean? It's got to be, what, 90s? 2000, you don't know, right?
What Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
What era does it take place?
Yeah, what era is that?
I think it's present.
Present.
I think it's
But I mean, present could be any time, right?
I think it's 2008 when it came. I think it's like it started then and it's come
okay,
now.
So, okay, yeah. Got it. Whereas Hell on Wheels is not present and it's not sexy. Although, it isn't sexy in the sense that Mad Men is sexy, you know what I mean? Bohannon is a sexy character, you know. Lily Bell definitely was sexy, but it's not like one of those. It's gritty, man. I mean, one can't help but think, you know, these people must have smelled really bad.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Where did they bathe? Yeah. How could you have a butcher shop in the middle of something? You know what I mean?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think that the show is necessarily sexy unless you like have a cowboy fixation or something, you know. But I think that what the show does do is it's, you know, it's so immersive that I hope that people, you know, kind of get a feel for what it really was like in those days. And I think we talk a lot about internally about trying to, you know, really capture the reality and kind of understand like just how difficult it really was. In season one when Lily was, in Hell on Wheels camp for the first time, and you see her nailing down the boards of the
floorboards because she just had a little riff with Thomas Durant because I think Durant wanted a little something more from her, and she was like, nah, and he goes, well, you can go sleep somewhere else if my high standard of living caboose isn't good enough for you or whatever the hell it was, and she's having a hard time nailing the floorboard down.
Yeah. Because it's just a tent and mud.
And mud.
And it's like, oh, yeah, I guess they would have to put down a floorboard. Yeah.
We're right now, we're in an hour and a half, I believe, southeast of Calgary.
Yeah.
And we're in, you guys shoot in a big old field near the river, and it's muddy, and it's hot, it's clammy, and you're exposed to all types of weather that these people would have been exposed to.
That's
and
right.
We have modern-day amenities, and even with modern-day amenities, that shit can't take away from the fact that you're out in the wilderness and mud and the elements.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge. I mean, that's the guys who, I mean, I can't imagine these actors who work, you know, 12 hours a day, every day, you know, every week, from the beginning of summer to the end. I mean, every year. I mean, they're incredible sports and they really go for it. I mean, they handle the elements just like their characters do, which I think is part of the, you know, when you think about Hell on Wheels, I hope one of the things you think about is like, yeah, these characters live and breathe. Like, they could be historical characters. This could be a historical fiction, but you don't know because they're just them. You know, that's not, we're not, we don't have like, aside from Thomas Durant, you know, we're not like using history as a crutch. We're actually telling a story that is more timeless, hopefully, than it is, you know, a period piece.
Right.
So.
Right. In the set design, the costumes, the level of commitment by all the players, like you just mentioned, behind the scenes and in front of the camera, is outstanding and amazing. Like I told you, I've watched all of the episodes on season one and two, and, you know, I can smell the dirt. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You can't, even when you get back to your hotel in Calgary, you'll still be smelling something.
I can smell the dirt from the TV. I'm watching it.
I'm thinking,
this is real deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you guys are not, you know, using history as a crutch, although it does have some sense of historical element, you know. So, in closing, I'll ask, you know, and ask you to talk a little bit about the ambitiousness of Hell on Wheels, okay? So it's a huge undertaking to recreate these towns, these like movable railroad towns, you
ten
know,
cities,
ten
yeah.
cities.
Yeah.
I mean, and the show must cost a fortune to do.
It doesn't cost a fortune, but I'm glad you said it does, because that it really, you know, I think, look, it is a challenge. And I mean, I think it's a challenge to do a quote unquote Western or a period piece in a way that really captures what we at AMC really value, which is like a character drama. And so, you know, not unlike Don Draper or Walter White or Rick Grimes, you know, Cullen Bohannon is a guy, a hero, who has a very specific arc to him. You know, he is a guy that changes over time. You know, in the first season, he was bent on revenge.
Right.
The second season, he was understanding what responsibility meant. And this season, you know, he's really fighting for control. I mean, it's going to be I think season three is going to be a massive thing. I hope that everybody likes it. I think it's great. It's really just fantastic.
I am so psyched. I really am. I mean, I watched the first season on Netflix, and I have to. And before I knew it was on Netflix, I would buy them on iTunes. And season two wasn't on Netflix up until like maybe a week and a half ago, and I had already seen season two, right? So, because I had to buy them on iTunes or whatever.
Yeah.
So like I'm like can't wait to see the whole season three.
So you didn't watch them live though. You didn't watch them live?
No. I didn't watch season one or season two live because I wasn't up on the show. I didn't know about the show until after season two was already done.
Got it.
You know, which is another reason. One of the other questions I'll ask is, so then why? I mean, I know a lot of people that watch TV, and so a lot of people I know were not, they're not aware of the show,
right.
You know, the first season or the second season, let alone. All of a sudden, season three comes along, and there's a lot more, you know, like, yo, Hell on Wheels is here. Like, how did that happen?
Listen, I think it's about, you know, being patient with a show. I think that shows find their audience eventually, but it takes a little while. I mean, it's just like, there's just so many other pieces of entertainment out there that are grabbing people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does take, I mean, especially the Hell on Wheels audience, I think is a little bit older, and they do have more options available to them. So it's one of those things that when we have a show like this, we know it's great, you know, and we know the audiences who have found it really like it, and we know that everybody who's making the show is on point. So it's just about being patient and like just letting people find it, and I think the more people that find it, the more people they want to introduce it to. So it's a self-sustaining thing.
Right. Well, that's one of the advantages of this show being done on AMC. Because
yeah.
if it was done anywhere else, forget it.
Yeah.
It would, you know, three episodes in, no one knows about it. You're gone. You know what I mean?
Television is not known for its patience. That's true.
No. So I am grateful that it's on AMC. I'm grateful that you guys are on season three. You're pretty much what we just did, episode eight. You got what, four more episodes to do?
No, just two.
Two more.
Two more.
That's
two.
It. Two
yeah,
more. Ten.
Two more.
Okay, and it's on a new night, Saturday night.
Saturday night, which we expect will be a big thing for the show. Our programming people love it. I think Saturday night has long been considered the graveyard of television shows. But you know, I think that...
But that's the graveyard of network TV shows, not necessarily cable shows.
That's right. That's what I said. Yeah.
So you guys have different rules. Cable TV has different rules. And as we've discussed here, AMC has completely different rules. I mean, you guys are on your own here. I mean, you guys kind of made up your own, you know, laws as far as programming goes.
Yeah, and we're not stopping. We're like saying, hey, Saturday nights, like, why not? Tell us it won't work.
Exactly. Why not?
Yeah, and I think that that also goes to the fact that, like, when you're patient with a show and you don't need it to perform right out of the gate, you know that it's good, you know that people are going to find it and love it, then, you know, why not put it on a Saturday night? I mean, and why not kind of build a whole weekend that's leading up to it? We've been programming Westerns for months now on Saturday nights, you know, with running spots for the show. So I think we're cultivating a viewership that's accustomed to getting this type of show on a Saturday night. I mean, it just feels like a great Saturday night show. It's escapist. It's fun. There's great characters. There's a little bit of romance. There's, you know, there's something for everybody, I think. And the action is impeccable. So I can't wait for people to rediscover the show in season three on Saturday nights.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Horn, for your time. Your salmon's cold. We're in a tent where everyone broke for lunch. Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to watch it live on Saturdays, and I'm definitely going to do my best to promote it.
August 10th, Hell on Wheels. August 11th, Breaking Bad finale, or Breaking Bad final season. And then at 10 is the premiere of Low Winter Sun, which is another show on Sunday night. So August 10th and 11th, big weekend for you.
I know a couple of people on Low Winter Sun, one of your writers and one of your directors. So that's amazing. That's amazing shit.
Yeah, they're very talented people, as you already know.
Yeah, unbelievable. Anyway, we'll definitely watch out, and thank you so much again.
Yeah, man, good to see you.
Almost an hour southeast of Calgary.
An hour southeast of Calgary. That's Anson Mount, who plays Cullum Bohannon.
Cullen. Close.
I'm like, all the Cullums, Cullen, McCullum, all the names up here, like, I get confused.
It's funny, these people, the crew has this running mistake amongst all of them where they inadvertently call me Common and they call Common Anson. Figured that one out.
That's hilarious. So I've watched every single episode from season one to season two, so I'm familiar with your character, the arc of your character in season one and the arc of your character in season two. Completely different.
How so? How do you think?
Well, I think in the first season, Bohannon is introduced as a hard ass, kind of like emotionless, although you do have a conscience in it. People, you're feared. In the second season, I think that there's a slight bit of emotion where Lily Bell kind of, like in the beginning, you can tell that Lily Bell is, there's some sort of attraction between you guys, but there's a little sexual tension, but not obvious. Mm-hmm. And then in the second season, it comes out slightly. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, you see a little, I got to see a little, a different side of Bohannon that I hadn't seen in the first episode, first season.
Good, that's good to know. Yeah, well, I mean, I think you say he was feared in the first season, and I guess you could look at it both ways. He was afraid, although he would never see it like that. Cullen had to be a lot more, in a lot of ways, a lot more courageous in the second season because of that stuff. And even more so this season, I think.
Got it. I remember, towards the end of the first season, which I watched episode 7 again the other night, where you free Common's character. So, and I think some of the guys want to shoot you, and I think one of the guys say, kind of, fuck you, you shoot him, and then they run out of the thing. So you're, you're really fucking feared. Like, no one wants to fuck with you.
Right. It's kind of fun playing a character like that. My friends at home just laugh at me.
Why is that?
Because I'm nothing like that. I'm not a tough guy like that.
You're completely the opposite of Bohannon.
In a lot of ways, yeah. I hate violence, and Bohannon is addicted to it.
Huh. Interesting. I kind of view Bohannon as someone who is experienced with violence because of his training, Civil War stuff. But I don't think that, that's his first recourse. You know what I mean? I don't think, the first thing he'll do is shoot you.
Well, yeah, he's too smart for that. But he is going to gravitate. He does, at least in the first two seasons, he's someone who gravitates towards conflict. That begins to change in the third season when he starts to consider the repercussions of his actions a little bit more.
Right. There were a couple of things that kind of threw me for a loop, and I'm not going to get too much into specifics because I would love for the listeners who haven't seen season one and season two, or the viewers, to actually go back and watch season one and season two, because they're both on Netflix and it's a kick-ass show. But there were certain things that happened in, for instance, the first season, I think it was, or was it the second season, when you decide to, get down with a gang that starts robbing trains, and that was kind of against your character, I thought,
Yeah, I wasn't actually overly fond of that beginning of second season. I thought that it was trying, to be quite blunt, I thought it was trying a little bit too hard to inject action and plot into something that should have been following a character-driven course more. It was very difficult to figure out a way to justify somebody who justify this idea that they think they're going to rob enough money to go down to Mexico and retire to a ranch. I just don't ever, never saw that in Cullen's imagination. So I just had to chalk it up to it being a lie he was telling to himself in order to once again find conflict.
Got it. Well, it didn't come across, you know, unbelievable, not believable. It was just that I'm following the character, exactly. You know.
Yeah, and plot always should follow character.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
Right.
And when character is forced to follow plot, the results are usually not very good, I don't think. But, you know, I was actually surprised by the stance because normally AMC is very much of the opinion that plot should follow character. You can see it in all of their shows. And for some reason we got into this sort of exciting plot-driven idea to kick things off, and I just didn't know how to deal with it.
Right. That's hilarious and honest at the same time. I appreciate that. So
it's just true. I don't give a shit. I mean I love my bosses and I love my network. But there are times when you're just like, why, what? You know, but that's the same is true of any collaborative creative situation. You're not always going to agree. And I'm dealing with people that, at least on the development side, that are a hell of a lot more experienced in creating good television than I am. So there are times when I have to just go, okay, you know what? Maybe they're right. And sometimes they are.
Right. So let's go back for the people that have never seen Hell on Wheels. What is the show about? What is what's Bohannon's character about? And why does he come to Hell on Wheels?
You mean at the beginning of the series?
Yeah, at the beginning of the series.
He's a former Confederate officer who is hunting down the men that were part of a union unit that raped and murdered his wife and killed his son, and he's tracked the last one or the last two down to this construction project that's beginning in Omaha that turns out to be the Transcontinental Railroad. So he embeds himself as a foreman in order to find these men. And that's one of the predominant parts of the first season is him hunting these men down. But slowly you start to realize that while he's hunting down these men, he's actually kind of punishing himself with every man that he kills. Because the reason is his... The guilt, really, a large part of the guilt for the death of his family is laid at his feet because he didn't have to fight in the war. He was rich enough to buy his way out of it. Mm. He saw a free Mississippi and an opportunity for perhaps a position within the government of a free Mississippi, and so he let his ambition get ahead of him, and he left his family alone, and they died. Mm. So what you're dealing with is a guy who's basically suffering really, really bad PTSD and is dealing with that through a kind of an addiction to violence. Mm. And I think I've never seen a protagonist like that. And so I just so love playing the character.
Well, it shows. That's one of the things I love about this show. First of all, it's kind of like, what is this? A history show? I mean, it has a lot of historical content. You have the Civil War. You got the building of the railroad. You got, you know, a lot of this cowboys and Indians type stuff. And it's just a rich show, and it's amazing the way it's done. The sets are amazing.
Well, you know, the creators had this really great saying when we began. They said, we're not making a Western. We're making an Eastern. Uh-huh. Because it's about this industrialization coming from the East Coast and violently cutting a swath through God's country. And they're right. I've never seen a Western capitalize on the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. And it's kind of unbelievable to me that this is the first time anybody's done it. It's just such a great story. And there's so much material to draw on.
Mm, Yeah, I mean, I had just recently watched a few months back that The Men Who Built America, and that those episodes kind of touched on the different contributors to, you know, shipping oil, cars, and also the building of the railroads. But there has never been a show that has dealt with it. So it's amazing. Tell me about the Swede, your relationship with the Swede. That's a fucked up. When I saw that guy, the first episode, I loved he had a shotgun underneath the table when you first came into the train, and I thought to myself, what a despicable scumbag, like probably one of the most nastiest fucking characters I had ever seen on TV.
Yeah, I mean, well, so much of that credit to that character obviously goes to Christopher Hierrell. He was originally hired on to do two episodes, and he was so good they thought, oh my god, we can't kill this guy. And he, I think the way he played the character really drove a lot of the writing. He sees, I don't want to speak for Chris, but he sees the Swede as someone who has become, for lack of a better word, enamored of or fixated upon the character of Cullen Bohannon. You know, he says at the end of season two, we have become consummated.
Mm-hmm.
He sees it as a experiment into the human condition to see how many ways he can toy with this man in order to hopefully get him to see his own hubris. And I think that's a wonderful motivation for a villain. I've never really seen anything quite like it.
Yeah, it's just at various points of season one, especially season two, you're thinking, why doesn't Bohannon just fucking cut his throat? I mean, at one point you had him locked up. And then I'm thinking, you know what I mean? So there's this cat and mouse game that keeps going on between you guys.
Well, and that's exactly what we've been trying to avoid in season three, because where we left our characters at the end of season two, you could, if they saw each other or encountered each other too early, you would end up with an entire season of cat and mouse, and
right.
You just can't play that.
Right.
So the writers have been really, really smart about drawing out the Swede storyline this season.
Right.
And the meeting point of these two characters comes closer to the end, and it is fantastic.
Awesome. I think I saw a preview of season three, and I said, you know, I'm not gonna. I saw the first episode, and I could have seen all of them because Rosemary's directing.
Right.
I said, you know what? No. Take them off, because I don't want to. You know, I just finished watching season two. So real quick, so summarize Bohannon's season one and season two, and how is he going to be different in season three?
The touchstone word for me coming into the season was maturation. I contend that Cullen Bohannon is a man dealing with addiction. As I've said, his addiction is violence.
Uh-huh.
And when you hit the rock bottom of any addiction, like he did at the end of season two, you have two ways to go: death, or you figure out a way to begin rebuilding yourself. And that determines a certain kind of self-awareness and maturation. So that, for me, became the idea of what his journey would be this season, and it also is determined by the fact that he's taking over this enterprise and is now really responsible for all of these men, a huge investment, and yet he still has not realized. I don't think he really quite realizes how the railroad is still kind of a placebo for this addiction to conflict. It's providing him his methadone in a way.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, I think that's it. I think you're going to be, you got to get ready to go onto set.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see the scene.
Yeah.
I saw the rehearsal of it. It sounds interesting. I can't wait to see the whole season three. I don't know if I want to start watching the first episode and have to wait for them to come or just wait.
I can't do that myself. I'm a huge Breaking Bad fan. And so for the past couple of seasons, I've just been getting I've been waiting until they air, and then I get the network to send me all the DVDs because I have to watch them back to back.
Right.
But this is the last season of Breaking Bad. I can't do that because everybody's going to be talking about it. So I'm going to have to figure out a way to DVR it or watch it every week. And it's just going to be killing me because I think it's the best TV show ever made.
Yeah.
It's so good. Bryan Cranston is just...
we'll talk about a cat and mouse game that it just keeps going on. How many times can you avoid getting busted for selling, you know, crystal meth and then reinventing yourself, you know?
Yeah, it's such good writing. It's such good development. It's such good insight on the part of the actors. And, you know, I think Vince Gilligan, in terms of the ability to ramp up tension in a scene and throughout an episode, I think he's the best out there. Mm. I don't know of a better writer in terms of that right now.
Right. So, yeah, it's a kick-ass show. So season 3, I heard, is moving to Saturday nights. Is that the premiere is going to be this coming Saturday, I believe?
Yeah. Yeah, we're moving to Saturday nights. I think this is AMC's first attempt to tackle Saturday nights. They've always been a Sunday night network, and for us, I think it makes sense because Saturdays have always been a big Western mm-hmm. day for them, and they've invested in some new properties this year, and so we'll see.
We'll see.
There's really nowhere to go back from there.
Right. Well, the good thing is viewers can still catch up with season 1 and season 2, and I believe AMC does marathons of the first and second season.
Yeah, we did a marathon of the first season last Saturday, and this coming Saturday, the 10th, before our premiere, is going to be the season 2.
Every episode?
Yeah, the season 2 marathon.
Oh, that's awesome. So awesome. I mean, I'm going to push the show, and hopefully we'll have season 3 and season 4.
That'd be great. Thanks, man.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate your time.
Of course.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really
call him meanie. You have this mean way about you anyway. I'm sure you get that a million times all over.
Well, I used to get it at school. That's just school, you know.
School.
Schoolyard joke.
Schoolyard. Of course, I wasn't even talking about the school. Nestor. I mean, I got Nestor the long-eared donkey. Yeah, I got it all. I wasn't even talking about that. I'm talking about more as an actor.
Yeah.
Have you predominantly played those types of characters?
No, I've had a, you know, a reasonable mix. I played a lot of bad guys, mean guys, but I've had the kind of the sweeter, charming, well, not so much charming, but the especially in more, the more comic roles are you know, less heavy. But Durant is not just a heavy. I mean, this, for those people who don't know the show, it's Thomas Durant is an historical character, and he owned the Union Pacific Railroad. He was the one who sort of started with this great vision, and he's very passionate about it. You know, he really wants to build this railroad, the first transcontinental railroad, 1860s, and to connect east and west coast. And he's you know, he points out a number of times to people that, you know, what now takes 7 months. You know, you had to take a ship in New York and go all the way down around South America. Right. There's no canal, remember?
Right.
Around the tip of Chile and back up to San Francisco. It took 7 months. So with his train, once his railroad is built, it will take 7 days.
7 days, and you'll have the option of first-class amenities for those that can afford it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just it's mind-boggling to the for people at the time, you know.
So why the big deal? I mean, this is for me and for everybody else who may not know the history of the United States. But why the big deal of wanting to go from the East Coast to the West Coast? What was in the West Coast that was so, you know, urgent?
It's like any kind of infrastructure, major infrastructure project. It's not just the connecting of two places; it's what happens along the way. I mean, already you see here, this set here is the beginnings of Cheyenne,
mm-hmm.
and it's which became, you know, a big Western city. It's as the railroad moves west, it opens up the land for development. It means you can get crops in and out. You can transport crops. You can transport livestock, you can transport manufactured goods.
Right.
It just opens the whole place up for development, which you couldn't do with a horse and wagon.
Right.
So there's that. I mean, it's as I say, it's not just the connecting of the two points east and west. It's all that goes with that. along right. the way.
Right. That's what Hell on Wheels pretty much covers.
Yes. Yes.
So, okay, so you said Thomas Durant isn't just a heavy. So Thomas Durant is based on a real character
yeah.
that was responsible for the building of the Union Pacific yeah. Railroad.
Yeah. He was a financier. He was involved in Wall Street. Originally, he was a qualified doctor. He was an eye doctor. And then he moved into finance, and he worked on Wall Street. And you know, just like they do today and have done forever, insider trading. And I think at the time there was less regulation than there is now.
If
you can believe that.
You think?
Yeah.
Less? Could you imagine that? Less insider trading?
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah. Well,
you know, there was less internet, so there was less access to instantaneous information.
What I was actually saying there was, I think there was even less regulation then.
No, I know. There was a lot more shiesty shit going on back then than there are now.
Well, there's still quite a bit going on.
Absolutely,
as we've learned in the last few years, but he's also a very smart guy, you know.
He's very smart.
Yeah, and he plays like he's involved in a project that is unprecedented. It's that partnership of government and private enterprise, where all the it's just perfect for manipulation
uh-huh.
and embezzlement
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
profiteering and
mm-hmm.
everything else. You know?
I watched the whole season one and the whole season two, and I just watched the 7th episode of season one, which is probably one of my favorite episodes mm-hmm. of the first season. And that's when you are traveling back to Chicago with Lily Bell, mm-hmm. and you confess to Lily Bell that, you know, you're having some troubles, and she says, "Oh, fucking man up." And you go and you trick or shiest the senator. Very fucking brilliant scene. At first, I didn't really understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But towards the end,
yeah.
I mean, he had the upper hand at the beginning of that
yeah,
meeting.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you're laughing and
yeah.
and you have his balls.
Yeah, exactly. Well, basically, it was a classic case of insider information.
Right.
My railroad will have to connect to one of two spur to take it into New York and take it into Philadelphia.
On the East Coast, yeah.
On the East Coast. So the Union Pacific will have to connect. Now, I already own one of those railroads.
Right.
So the assumption is that I will connect the Union Pacific to that railroad
right.
to take it into Philadelphia.
Right.
I allow that rumor to get started, and the stock in that small railroad goes way up.
Way up.
And when it reaches what I think is about as high as it's going to go, I sell my shares in that railroad quietly, make a huge profit, and then announce that, in fact, the Union Pacific will connect with the other railroad. So it means the share price of the original railroad drops completely.
Manipulation of stock.
Exactly.
Brilliant. I mean, that's...
And he actually did this and is reputed to have made $5 million in 1865 or 66. $5 million in a week.
Yeah, I was watching... on the History Channel, The Men Who Built America, and Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was the shipping mogul at the time and owned a lot of stock in railroad, I believe was the man responsible for the Grand Central Station in New York City, where is the port of all, I mean, pretty much all the trains coming in and out. He got shysted many times in the same way, sold phony stock,
yeah.
and then eventually came to find out that they were just bullshit pieces
yeah.
of paper.
Yeah. There was a lot of that, a lot of snake oil salesmen and shysters, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, your character is not, like you said, not just a heavy, not one, you know, not just an asshole, not just a shyster. You have various layers to that character.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's obviously he's driven by money and the profit motive and all that, but he's also, I mean, he does become passionate about this. This is like the equivalent of going to the moon, the 1960s. You know,
right.
the 1860s, building a transcontinental railroad was like that.
Right.
And he becomes very passionate about it. And apart from the money and the profit and all that, he wants to be the guy to do it. He wants to be remembered as the guy who built this fucking railroad. You know,
right.
It becomes very important to him. So there's a certain idealism there as well, almost. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like I'm the one responsible for this. But in season one, you're responsible, or you're building the transcontinental railway. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then something happens in season two that you wind up having to leave that endeavor, and then once again convincing investors to entrust you with the high task and the high risk.
Yeah, there's. I mean, the Union Pacific was the east to west arm, if you like, or leg of the transcontinental railroad.
Oh, okay, so got it.
I'm building that. Collis Huntington Beach in California.
Oh, wow.
Is building the other way. He's building from the west to the east.
Oh.
And we're going to meet. And the famous Golden Spike, of course, was put in Colorado.
Oh, wow.
Where the two branches met.
Okay.
And
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah. I don't have the whole historical content of it. Yeah. But that's what I love about it.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of history here, and it's great history, and it's fascinating and dramatic, you know. So he's responsible for that. But he has, I mean, within the Union Pacific, the railroad that he kind of controls and runs and is building, he has a lot of competition. There's a lot of other guys who want to do what he's doing. So he's constantly having to sort of move money around and you know, deficit spending and all this sort of crap goes on. You know, he's pulling money from here, you know, from Peter.
Borrowing for Potter to pay.
Yeah, exactly. And
which is probably where that term originated.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He overextends himself at times. He leaves himself open to all sorts of accusations. And he does. At the end of season two, he gets caught. He gets caught with his pants down. And it looks like he's on the way out.
Yeah, I can't imagine why. Well, obviously, your life was in danger all the time, right? So you had guys, ahead of security that kind of kept the men in check, had them work and secure the payroll and all that other stuff. But I never saw that you had a you had a bodyguard. You never had someone 24 hours with you.
No, he didn't. And
which is ballsy. Think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think he was. He wasn't so. I mean, he always felt he could talk his way out of situations and buy his way out of situations. So he never felt that he was really under threat. Like if somebody kind of had a beef with him, he would buy them off or talk them out of it or whatever, you know.
Or get somebody like the Swede to get you back.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So season one, the guy who you have, your foreman, for lack of a better word, gets killed. Mm-hmm. And then Bohannon comes in. You know of Bohannon, and you entrust Bohannon with the job, mm-hmm. right? Because you think he'd be a good guy to keep your men in line, and he's feared, and mm-hmm. so he does. Mm-hmm. And then season two... things start changing a little bit now. In season three, you and Bohannon are in competition.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, you know, Bohannon. I when I hire him, I believe he's a guy who will get things done. He's a Southerner, mm-hmm. And I believe that he can. I think Durant always suspected that Bohannon was not just a sort of a grunt. You know, he wasn't. And as we learn later, he does actually come from quite a. You know, not quite aristocratic.
A wealthy background.
He owned and ran an estate in the South.
And you also know, I mean, you get that he's not just a gunslinger. He's very smart, business and
exactly,
otherwise.
Exactly. So this is what impresses Durant about Bohannon. So he hires him to do this job. But as time goes by, of course, he does it. He does it well. And he becomes a threat.
Right.
He gets ambitious as well. And he wants to take over. He feels he can do what Durant is doing.
Well, like you said, in season two, you get caught with your pants down. And the other aspect of it is that, you know, again, season one, Durant hires Bohannon to kind of put his men in line, meaning the people who are working to do the railroad. He can be the foreman. He can get the project done most efficiently, right? Because it's hard work. But then I think in season two, I think Bohannon kind of starts feeling the way you feel, whereas like... I've helped build this. This is my baby. Exactly. I'm not going to let this go.
Exactly. He starts to develop a sort of proprietorial sort of
pride.
Yeah, yeah. He feels certainly vested in the railroad. He feels that it's he has achieved this more so than I have, because I've spent a lot of time away,
right,
doing other things.
He's done the grunt work, really. You just basically got the money to come by and dealt with the administrative crap.
Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't want to give too much and ask too many questions. I really love the show. I mean, I really do. For many reasons. The acting is amazing. The characters are, you know, quadruply dimensional. Mm. The historical context is pretty accurate. The set design is unfucking believable. Mm. You know, the props are amazing. Yeah. How do you feel about season 3 in comparison to the first two seasons?
Good. We've you know, I think we've sort of we've moved forward. We're further west. The railroad is, you know, we're getting a lot done, a lot achieved, and there's been a lot of casualties along the way, including almost myself, and that I spent a little stretch in jail.
Oh wow!
But managed to talk his way out of that too.
Right, right.
And it's interesting, and this actually happened. He was sidelined for a while, and then came back stronger and took over the railroad again. And that's kind of where we go with season 3.
And let's not forget season 2. You battle with a little bit of addiction, which is pretty wild.
Exactly. Yes, he was shot and badly, gut shot, as they said. And in his recovery from that, he became addicted to morphine and spent quite a while.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better addiction. and you do quite an amazing job.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. I really love that.
Yeah.
You know, an 1860s heroin addict.
I just took a little, you know.
A little bit. Your character arc from first, second, and 13, are you satisfied with that?
Yeah, very much. I mean, he's gone from being the lion who's sort of leading this forward and the dominant man, and it's great to see him kind of have his problems and have his setbacks, and because, you know, you can't just play that. I mean, you know, it's a bit boring if he's just the guy who gets
right
his way all the time
and who has all the money and is always in power.
Yeah, and so it's nice to see him. And dramatically, it's very interesting to see him have these setbacks, and he certainly has. I mean, he's been shot. He's been addicted
in jail.
To caffeine. He's been
addicted.
In jail. He's been, you know, he's been done for embezzlement. He's a lot of things happen to him, but he manages to come back every time. You know.
Yeah, very meaty character, Thomas Durant. Well, thank you so much, Colomini, and I think we're gonna have dinner with you tonight, right?
I think we are, absolutely. You and your lovely wife, Rosemary.
Yeah. Rosemary Rodriguez, the director of episode. What is this? Eight.
Eight. Episode 8.
Episode 8. I can't wait to start watching the season from scratch. I'm probably going to DVR all of them and watch them all in like two nights.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Nestor.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye.
What's the name of your character again? Elam?
Yeah.
What's your last name? Do you have a last name?
Yeah, I got a last name, thank God. Because, you know, a lot of slaves, former slaves, they took on their master's last name. And my last name is Ferguson.
Right.
Yeah, that actually wasn't my master's last name. But my character, he definitely got his own last name. And even if he didn't have one, he's strong enough, he would have came up with one.
How do you go from being a hip-hop artist to acting in kind of like a historical period piece that actually deals with, you know, the Reconstruction period of America, slavery, racism, all those things all in one, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, it's like when you do art, like, I do hip-hop with all my heart and soul. So when I made the transition and growth into acting, I put all my heart and soul into it, and I just study it and just just be the best I can be and learn as much. So it's like not only a challenge, but it's a blessing for me to be able to come and do a period piece, because, you know, as an actor, I know I can do that. As an actor, I could play a doctor, I can play a priest, I can play a chef, I can do English accent, I could do whatever, like, I'm an actor. So it's great for me to get a chance to exercise that on this show, you know, and people, you know, hopefully can see the heart and soul that comes through.
I think the heart and soul comes through. I think it comes through, you know, a million times over. That's not even an issue on this show. Everyone here, you know, gives the, you know,
I mean, you don't even, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's acting, right, as it should be.
Yeah.
But you said you're an artist, and I totally get that. Did you come about music first, or did you always aspire to be in theater and be in front of the camera?
Well, no, music was definitely my first thing. And realistically, I honestly, as a kid, wanted to be a basketball player. I wanted to be in the NBA. I used to play ball and stuff, but music started coming naturally because hip-hop was like, it was so relative to my life, so I just started breakdancing and writing raps, and it was like, oh man, it's just something I'm doing for fun. But then at one point, it was like, man, it was always a desire in me to be like a star in a way that like people knew who I was, knew I lived on this earth doing something. So like I found that through music. I always loved film and theater. I would love to go to the movies, and I love going to plays. I never thought about doing it myself till I got into my mid-20s. And I was like, man, I just want to do something else artistically. And that's when I just started going to acting classes, and that's what did it.
Well, you're natural. You make it seem effortless, you know. I mean, I remember seeing, I'm not sure if it was the first episode, but I remember the first time I saw you on an episode of Hell on Wheels. I mean, y'all are slaves, freed slaves, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And you're, for lack of a better word, I mean, you could call it a chain gang because what's the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're building the railroad, and one of the foreman, Durant's foreman,
Johnson,
you know, as far as he's concerned, y'all are still slaves.
Yeah, basically.
You know what I mean? And the first thing you see is the look on your eyes, you know, towards him, like, you know, I've done, you know, came out of this bullshit not to be taking your bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's all in your eyes in that episode. And then eventually it goes into, you know, the journey of Elam Ferguson, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, it's funny because, like, sometimes when I look at the first episode, I can see, like, the progress of me as an actor from there to now. And I don't even watch the episodes now. Like, not, I watch them when they come out, but I don't like watch them before. I can't say I've seen myself now, but just the it feels even greater now and more natural. I just gotta say, it's like I can look at that first episode and see where Elam was and see also where I was as an actor. And now I can see Elam has progressed, and you know, and for him it ain't just only like, let me show these white men that I'm a human being. It's about, like, really being that human being and creating a family for himself and taking care of business and rising high and above what anybody expected him to be. And so now his plight is not like, well, let me prove to the white man that I'm worthy of this. It's like, no, let me create this for myself. Let me do this. Like, I want my family to be good. I'm not even thinking about what they think about me, you know, so... It's a lot of growth in Elam, and it gave me a lot of places to grow as an actor. And, yeah, man, I'm grateful. This show has been one of the biggest blessings I've had artistically.
Yeah, you know, that I was going to... One of the questions I asked Anson and Colm was the arc of their characters. I mean, you pretty much broke it down, whereas, which is... I wouldn't have put it in, you know, those words myself, but makes sense. Whereas, like, you want to prove to them... the white man that you're just as good as them, or you're equal to them, or you can do what they can do, as opposed to, I don't need them to, you know, approve of me. Exactly. I'm going to create my own destiny, which is, you know, very spiritual and very powerful.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, it's very powerful. And I think, you know, that's part of what drives Elam. And he is a spiritual human being, you know, like, especially when you think about where a lot of former slaves or people that were enslaved had to go through, a lot of them, all they had to get them through it was God and their belief in God and their spirituality. So Elam definitely has that. And I think, you know, going from the place of, like, being enslaved and being owned by somebody and then, you know, really trying to define yourself. When he first come out to this railroad, it's like, what am I going to do? You know, I'm used to being on this person's time. Like, I got to get up when they say get up. When the bell ring, I got to eat. I only got 5 minutes for lunch. I got to do to being able to like create something for yourself and have make your own choices pretty much. Not that prejudice just stopped, but you weren't on anybody else's clock at that point. Now it's like, you know, when you first go to college, you gotta like you gotta go do make things happen. You ain't like on the set schedule like you are in high school. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what? You got money. Your class is being paid for. What are you gonna do? You're gonna go to class on time. What are you gonna get out of it? Yeah. What are you gonna put into it?
Yes,
what's your overall goal? What's your purpose?
Yeah. Exactly. So he like many other people that came out here to this railroad were coming to redefine themselves and find who they are and really contribute to something. You know, I can remember when I was younger, I used to always be proud because my uncle helped build or did something on the Sears Tower.
Mm.
I'd be like, man, my uncle helped build this. It made me feel proud of being there. And that's what Elam want to feel good about himself. He coming to help build something that's one of the biggest, not only just finding a job and taking care of himself, but he coming to be a part of something that's one of the greatest adventures of all time. You know, this was a big thing.
And achievements of all time, but especially of that time, because no one had gone from east to west, and you know that transcontinental railway that undertaking had not happened ever before. So you know the possibilities are forever. Yeah, I could identify with that. Identify with a family. I mean, I was an electrician, so I've worked on many buildings in New York City, and I think about, you know, those lights that light up Grand Central. Yeah. I worked on those. You know what I mean? So I get it. You know, because as a human being, you ask yourself, like, what is my contribution to this world? And you don't have to be famous or a movie star, or you don't got to be a big star to have some sort of a contribution to this world. You know what I mean?
And that's to me. That's what we're here for. Like we here to contribute to the world, and your purpose may be, I mean, teachers are just as important, if not more important, than movie stars and entertainers. You know, teachers, electricians are just as important as, you know, a football player. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we all contribute, and it's like how will you contribute? Not just by your profession, but how will you contribute as a human being? What are you gonna give to your children, to society, to the stranger you walk past? What are you gonna, you know, contribute? You can contribute just by planting a seed and being nice to a person. You know, so yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I felt like for me, Common. I felt like growing up, I want to contribute to the world, and I'm finding that Elam is wanting to contribute in his own way.
That's a blessing, right?
To be
able to kind of like parallel or juxtapose your spiritual path as a human artist, human/artist, and be able to play a role that you could actually, you know, kind of grow and evolve with and through. You know what I mean? That's pretty wild.
That's incredible, really. And I mean, you know, the more and more I get to perform as an actor, the more and more I understand the divine expression in it and get to, you know, really look at it from different levels, from a spiritual level, artistic level, which connects to the spirit, and also just fun. You know, it's fun, it's creativity. Like, the more and more I get that, I understand it. Like, you know, some roles, one of my acting teachers told me, like, some roles is put in your life for your life. You know what I mean? Like, I do believe this was a role that is putting my life on my life. Yeah.
Yeah. You might not ever get to do a role for your life of this magnitude ever again.
Yeah. Well, I hope to get like more roles that really mean something to my life and can inspire other people too. Because that's one thing I've noticed about acting that you can do too, is like you inspire other people. You not only you entertain, but you inspire. You give, you know, I don't know, it's something to it that when I watch movies that bring out emotions in me and I relate to the people and it makes me sometimes, some of them films make me want to go out and do better, you know.
Well, absolutely. I mean, your acting definitely is inspiring. You know, I've seen a lot of, you know, I don't want to say hip-hop artists, but a lot of musicians, a lot of artists that come from other different, you know, arenas and then dabble in acting. And they're okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you have managed to not just be okay, but you've managed to create, you know, and carve out a part that's like, you know, like not just believable, but it's coming from your essence. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to first cite like some of the great artists that I think our musicians and our great actors like Mos Def and like Will Smith, I think is good, and Queen Latifah.
Oh yeah.
Like, so I definitely got to give them like props, and I got to say they all been inspirations for me. But I will say, you know, when I approached acting, I never came in like, let me be one of the best rapper actors. I want to be one of the best actors.
Uh-huh.
You know, I want to be a great American actor.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's what I want to do, and that's, you know, that's what my vision is for myself, and that's what I strive for.
Right, right. I know you probably got to wrap up, and I'd love to talk to you about a million up. I know you got to wrap up, and I know you got to. I got about a million other questions, hip hop related, and all that other stuff. So I ain't gonna get into all that. But real quick, just to wrap this segment up about the arc of your character, how has Elam evolved from season one and through season two and now season three? I mean, I got my own moments. I don't want to break it into, you know, for those that haven't seen season one or two, but how has that character evolved from season one through season two and now season three?
Well, yeah, as we spoke a little bit earlier, when Elam first came here, it was really about coming from the plantation and after the Civil War, really just defining who he is as a black man. As a black man, really like saying, hey, I am a human being, like, you're going to give me this equality. But then eventually throughout that season, he started, like, relating to Cullen Bohannon, who was a white man who was a former slave owner. And, and it's like, they related, and then at the same token, you know, they weren't connected all the way. So he kind of started getting a different understanding of what the white man is to him, you know, and in a way that's like, look, this guy was a slave owner, but I don't hate him. You know, it's like he's helped save my life at a certain point. I helped save his life. So he's a human being. So Elam is, his world is opening up in that way. But then in the next season, as he continues to rise and progress, you see him leave behind some of the freedmen, some of his community, which happens sometimes with people to get popular, get money, get, you know, certain notoriety and positions. They sometimes forget their roots.
Mm.
He forgot his roots at one point. And he also, during the process of all that going on in his position, he fell in love with a woman who really was difficult to have a relationship with because she's a white woman that's a former prostitute. But it wasn't that she was a former prostitute. It was just more because she was a white woman trying to exist in this world. And she eventually, because they couldn't get it together, got married. So he dealt with that in his love arc. And then also at the same token, trying to progress as a man rising. He eventually came back to his community and declared his love for this woman. And she gets pregnant, and they're about to have a baby. You find him in season three really trying to find how to rise up even higher in his ranking when he's given a really high position in the building of the railroad, and then also how to take care of a family. And it's something that I feel like we deal with as people in this present day. It's like, okay, I got my job, and this job is already giving me challenges. And now I got a family, and I got to keep everything straight at home, too. And that's what he's been dealing with, really trying to keep his family okay and keep his job beyond all the outside things that come, whether it's natives, other people that come to challenge their growth of the railroad. He has to go with his own inner challenges.
Brilliant. Hell on Wheels season three. I'm definitely looking forward to it. And if you haven't caught season one and two, definitely catch those on Netflix. And I'm pretty sure AMC is going to be doing marathons of those first two seasons.
Yeah.
You definitely got to watch the first and two before you go on to three. You know what I'm saying?
Sir.
You have to do it.
Yes, sir. Yes.
You know, because I'm pretty sure season three is going to be dope right off the bat. You know what I mean? But it helps if you watch the first two seasons.
You got to watch the first two seasons just to get in tune with it. But season three, we rise into the occasion. Y'all look out for it.
Yeah. I'm going to catch you up another time and talk about hip-hop.
I mean, sir.
I grew up in New York City at the genesis of the hip-hop, you know, movement era, the Rocksteady crew. I mean, I know from, like, the rapping to the graffiti to the breakdancing. So, like, I know, like, you know, a lot of cats that, you know, started that, evolved, and have made it to, you know, what it is now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we definitely can get into a talk about hip-hop. That's That's my first love. So,
Well, I want to get schooled on hip-hop from, you know, your generation and where you came in on the map of that and, you know, what inspiration, where you took off and where you left that, you know what I mean? Yeah. Or where you're at with it in the big picture.
Yeah, well, we definitely will build on that. But make sure y'all go check out Hell on Wheels. It's coming on AMC every Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central. AMC Hell on Wheels Season 3. Y'all stay in tune with it. Much love.
Big the fuck up to all the Hell on Wheels cast and crew. Extras, principals, directors, cinematographers, lighting gaffers, special effect, producer, every motherfucker. AMC, big up, big up.
Encourage me the whole way along. Ow. I ain't doing nothing but talking shit. So y'all gotta, like, you know, encourage me the